This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. If you have Alzheimer's disease or think you may have Alzheimer's disease, Health Initiatives Research is seeking participants to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an oral study drug that may slow the progression of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. More information is available at 871-1771.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we learn more about the implications of new research on tornadoes, plus a conversation about ethics in Arkansas politics.
And the Bumpers College at the University of Arkansas receives a surprise ranking. And we also spend time at a Decatur farm learning techniques for raising chickens and more.
But first, while on the road in Arkansas yesterday, Republican Senator John Bozeman stopped in Texarkana. Senator Bozeman was on a tour of cities with Dan Hendricks, president of the World Trade Center in Arkansas. After meeting with members of the Bi-State City's Chamber of Commerce, Senator Bozeman gave his view on taking action against the Syrian government's alleged use of chemical weapons on its own people. Senator Bozeman says he favors diplomacy over military involvement towards Syria.
The Assad regime, the guy's a tyrant by any, you know, definition of the name, and so he doesn't really respond to world pressure. He's just trying to hang on. But yes, we can hurt them even more so, I think, from a economic standpoint, calling our allies, which would I think would be more willing to do things like that than they are even now, based on the use of chemical weapons, as opposed to the airstrike.
He says there are many questions he would like to see answered, including an explanation of the president's broader Syria policy and strategy.
This is serious in the sense that as soon as you drop that bomb, that's an act of war. And we are becoming involved in the situation. And I don't know right now that we have a clear path as to whether or not we need to escalate this or not.
President Obama landed in Sweden today to begin a European tour that will take him to the G20 summit, where he's expected to try and build support for his plan of military intervention in Syria.
Last week, the University of Arkansas announced preliminary enrollment totals for the new academic year. Now, Northwest Arkansas Community College has followed suit. As of the 11th day of classes yesterday, 8,102 students were enrolled, representing a decrease of about 3.8% from the fall 2012 enrollment numbers. But Stephen Hines, director of communications at NWAC, says any decreases in enrollment are not overly surprising. He says enrollment at community colleges tends to run inverse to trends in the economy.
When the economy sees an improvement, as we have here in Northwest Arkansas, some people who may have been taking a class with us or a few classes with us even in order to get a job or to get a better job, well, when the economy improves, then many of those people suddenly return to the workforce or have been able to get maybe the better job that they wanted, and they may drop from us. And so while we are, you know, always, of course, wanting more students, it's certainly nothing unusual in terms of how community colleges enrollment works, and it's also reflective of a national trend.
Hines says the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center released a report in May that showed a 3.6% decrease in enrollment for spring 2013 versus spring 2012 at two-year colleges, putting enrollment trends at NWAC on par with national trends. In addition, the 1,286 degrees awarded to Northwest Arkansas Community College graduates earlier this year was a record for the college, meaning more freshmen would be needed to make up for the number of students who graduated. The total number of new freshmen at NWAC is up for the semester, with 1,682 being counted in the preliminary total. That's an increase from the 1,556 freshmen a year ago. Additionally, the number of students taking NWAC classes at the Jones Center and the Washington County Center, both in Springdale, jumped 17% for each facility. Hines says the increased enrollment for classes in Washington County is a positive sign as the college continues toward building a facility of its own in the county.
I think it is certainly one piece of information that we need to consider, and I think that it does seem to speak to the fact that more and more students want to take classes with us in Washington County. So we are encouraged by those numbers. I think that we have to look at, you know, a number of factors as we're considering that location, but it certainly is a very positive indicator right now.
This year, 488 students are enrolled in classes at the Jones Center, just over 900 students enrolled in classes at the Washington County Center on White Road.
The city of Rogers is in the preliminary stages of developing a strategic development plan for its downtown area. While some may already consider the historic downtown district vibrant, Rogers Mayor Greg Hines says the plan to be developed would look beyond its current boundaries.
It really looks at how we tie a much larger geographic area to the vitality of that central heart of downtown. And it focuses a lot more on how do we make it a livable, walkable residential district that also supports, viable commercial endeavors.
Hines says the eventual plan for downtown Rogers would tip more in favor of commercial interests for residents rather than tourists, which, in his opinion, is how to create a sustainable downtown area. But he says the plan to be developed will recognize that downtown areas, especially those in the South, typically reinvent themselves every couple of decades.
You know, it moves sort of in a direction that the owners of the buildings want to see it move, or the tenants that they get. And what we want to see in that particular area is how do I attract and how do I create some different zoning and some different compatible components for living and retail and commerce in downtown, so that the businesses that you see on those storefronts, those are businesses that are supporting the residents that live in the greater downtown area, not as much focused on bringing people from other areas.
Although he and other city officials are pushing for development of the strategic downtown plan, Hines says he hopes it will become something that is developed on a continual basis rather than with a specific time frame.
The Keep Arkansas Beautiful Commission is encouraging Arkansans to help pick up the natural state. The annual Great Arkansas Cleanup Campaign begins this weekend and will run through the end of November. It will take place at state parks, communities, and many other public areas. Liz Philpott is a spokeswoman with the Keep Arkansas Beautiful Commission.
The Great Arkansas Cleanup is just a great opportunity for Arkansans to express their civic pride. They can do this by sprucing up their communities. We ask volunteers to clean up their parks, pick up litter from along roadways and shorelines, and just really get out in their communities all across the state and get involved and just really make them shine.
Last year, the Great Arkansas Cleanup gathered more than 11,000 volunteers at 93 events across the state, and those volunteers collected more than 800,000 pounds of litter. With such an impact, Philpott says the Great Arkansas Cleanup is important to the state.
They make this state look really nice. Everybody likes a clean community. But more than that, it's important because it gives citizens and communities a chance to get together and build that sense of community and really just work toward a common goal and then feel pride after they complete that goal, because you're going to feel great about a place that you really put the effort into, and you can look back and say, you know, we did that together.
The first round of Cleanup Arkansas events takes place this weekend. There are various locations for scheduled coordinated cleanups, including the annual Lee Creek cleanup this weekend at Devil's Den State Park. But Philpott says many different groups coordinate cleanup events, from Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops to Rotary clubs to neighborhood organizations. More information can be found at keeparkansasbeautiful.com.
Unofficial results are in from yesterday's runoff election to fill the vacancy on Springdale City Council. Mike Lawson garnered 56% of the vote with 491 votes in his favor, while Rick Culver received the remaining 44% of the vote with 379 votes cast in his favor. Lawson will be sworn in to take the Ward 4 Position 1 seat once the election results are certified.
Clear tonight. Lows will be in the upper 50s in northwest Arkansas, mid-60s for the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow, highs from 89 to 93. And for Thursday night, mostly clear, lows from 57 to 63.
This is Ozarks at Large. 2 weeks ago, Democratic State Senator Paul Bookout resigned from office after an Ethics Commission fine regarding him using campaign money for personal use. This week, Republican and Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar exited the 4th District Congressional race after a blog called The Blue Hog Report uncovered discrepancies on his campaign filings. Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas sat down with Dr. Jay Barth, professor of political science with Hendricks College, to discuss ethics in Arkansas.
This ethics debate and this momentum that is building around discussion of ethics and what might happen at the legislature, not happen at the legislature, is it peaking too early in terms of allowing for something to be done? I mean, might we be tired of talking about ethics by the 2015 session?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that it's happening at a crucial time, actually, in terms of candidates' decisions to run. And, you know, as Lieutenant Governor Darr's departure from that race reshapes that 4th District race, I think, in an important way. I don't think this is too early. And not only do we have the elections that are going to be part of the cycle, but we also, of course, have the initiative that constitutional amendment that's been proposed by the legislature, which is going to be voted on in 14, and then, of course, the 15 session. And so I think we're going to hear a lot about ethics, and it's about time. I mean, it's we've had these kind of bursts of interest in ethics reform over the years, especially in the late 80s, early 90s. Got into the national mainstream on ethics, but since then it's really kind of stagnated.
And we may hear more about ethics just by the simple fact that there may be more carcasses on the side of the road before this is all over, because there is this renewed scrutiny and looking at a lot of these different public filings that are out there. And, you know, I would make the point, too, Mark Darr's filings were out there for 2 to 3 years. Bookouts have been out there for longer than that.
Right. And you noted, you know, who broke the story. And this is not mainstream media. This is a blog-based journalism. And that's what these guys, I think, do particularly well, is that they have the patience to dig into these reports. One of the big problems with the Arkansas ethics system, it's very hard to difficult to find this information. You really have to go through these often blurry PDF files, and it takes a lot of patience. And, you know, kudos to these guys who are beginning to uncover these stories.
There could be some minor reforms done in 2014. As we reported about a week ago, talked with Graham Sloan at the Ethics Commission, talked to some of the legislators that are out there. They could, in the 2014 fiscal session, add more staff to the Ethics Commission to kind of review or even preview some of these reports as they come in. Do you see that as something that may or may not happen?
I think it's an important addition, no matter what happens long term, because it's an understaffed group, very small staff, and that staff, I think, has been pretty flat over the last number of years. And so I think that is an important change, and they're certainly going to need more staff if there is some legislative action that kind of increases the scope and nature of ethics scrutiny in the state.
What do we know about voters and ethics? We've polled this a little bit in the past. You've obviously looked at some other polling information and data, not just in Arkansas, but nationwide. What do voters like about ethics? What do they not like about ethics? Where are they kind of centered on the subject matter?
Well, it's kind of mom and apple pie, right? I mean, who doesn't like ethics? some would argue that some ethics issues are a little intrusive into the lobbying.
I can think of some former legislators that don't like ethics.
And a few lobbyists who don't like ethics reform. It's, you know, these things, when they've been on the ballot in 88, 90, they passed overwhelmingly. And, you know, the polling that we've done around a similar ethics package that was considered put out there for petition in the last cycle, you know, it was going to be a slam dunk if it had made it on the ballot. You know, that's a very difficult process. They didn't get there with the petitions. An initiative is going forward from the legislature. It is a little more complicated because it's got some other bells and whistles tagged on it. Some bells and whistles may actually be a little bit of a problem for that.
Well, hold that thought there. Let's pull up a graphic here, I think, that we have. Let's talk about this ballot item that you're talking about referred by the legislature. This ethics proposal will be on the ballot at the general election in 2014. It would ban gifts to elected officials. It would ban corporate and union contributions. It would extend term limits to 16 years cumulative in the legislature. Extend that cooling off period for a legislator to become a lobbyist from 1 year to 2 years, and create this citizens commission to set elected official salaries. It's got some specifics as to who. So I guess, do you think that the term limits aspect of this, which is a highly contentious issue with voters, does that kill this potential reform, or do you think it just cuts into its support?
I don't, you know, I think this is still a significant favorite. We haven't polled this this whole package yet. I do think that the way in which it's framed as an ethics reform package. I think that's the lead, and I think that probably does help. I do think there, for the, if there is money to fight it, there are two, I think, real points of attack. I think, as you mentioned, the term limits extension is I think, an important line of attack with this thing. And I do think also, you know, the final item that you mentioned, which is the possible expansion of salaries, is another point of attack. And so we will see if there's the money and resources to do it. I'm a little dubious whether those who have historically opposed ethics reform are gonna get that involved in this because of the way in which the tides are blowing. I guess I've mixed a metaphor there, but the winds are blowing on ethics in Arkansas. There's one other piece to this. This reform is not a absolute gift ban. It does allow dinners to be paid for groups, identifiable groups, committees, etc. That's a point of some real controversy about this, and kind of ethics purists don't like that very much.
Doesn't go as far as the Walmart rule, which
exactly.
is banning everything, even down to a cup of coffee. You can't really spend a dime on them,
exactly.
so there is a little bit of flexibility there. All right, we're seeing something, too. I'm going to shift gears with you a little bit, but stay on the realm of politics. We're seeing something that we have not seen a lot, if ever, in Arkansas, and that we have contested Republican primaries, and there seems to be a lot of them. And what we see in the Democratic side of the field is what we used to see on the Republican side, and that is uncontested primaries,
right.
where there seems to be almost some favoritism and some clearing of the field going on. What do you make of this trend? Are we seeing some flip of the equation?
We are in some ways. I mean, you know, one sign of a healthy party is competitive primaries, and this used to be the norm in the Democratic side, as you suggest. The potential problem for a party is if that competitiveness turns into factionalism, right, and really divides the party in an important way. I think that's an important question. Is this really going to lead to some kind of more moderate candidates versus more Tea Party candidates that creates some problems moving forward with maybe slightly less electable candidates being nominated? I think
same could be said on the Democratic side, though, in the past,
right.
too. You
exactly.
could have someone going way too far left
right.
and someone not quite in the center.
Right. And we have, I think, seen a couple of cases of that. I think one thing is a little different. You know, back in the day when it was this, you know, Democratic primary was very active, there often were just token candidates on the other side. And I do think, you know, when you look at Mike Ross, when you look at John Burkhalter, I mean, those are quite good candidates. And in fact, I think they were probably advantaged by having their primary fields cleared. That said, I think that all things being equal, you know, you'd rather have that be the center of action rather than a place where people aren't showing up.
That was Dr. Jay Barth, professor of political science with Hendricks College, speaking to Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at aecc.com.
Recent research at the University of Arkansas suggests that the damage caused by tornadoes is affected by variances in the terrain the tornado encounters. But, as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis explains, the results of the research aren't so cut and dry.
According to data from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, 2012 saw just fewer than 30 strong or violent tornadoes, but more than 80 such tornadoes occurred across the nation in 2011. For the purposes of its annual count of strong or violent tornadoes, the administration counts all tornadoes classified as an EF3 or higher, or tornadoes with estimated 3-second wind gusts upward of 136 miles per hour. Two especially damaging tornadoes during that 2011 season were the EF4 tornado that struck the Tuscaloosa and Birmingham, Alabama area, and the EF5 tornado that devastated Joplin, Missouri. Dr. Panir Selvam is a civil engineer at the University of Arkansas, and he has studied tornadoes for more than 30 years. In a recent study, he looked at the damage paths of these two storms. In his assessment, he used tools that weren't available 3 decades ago.
We have done a lot of work on computer modeling. Then again, we want to have some verifications. In addition, we were also looking at some of the ideas, new ideas, so that we can be able to protect buildings or from damages. So what we did is we tried to take the damage path that is already available from Google Earth, and then trying to see whether the terrain has any influence on the tornado forces on or the wind field around that area.
Dr. Selvam says that he and his graduate students use data from the Joplin and Tuscaloosa tornadoes for a few simple reasons.
When we looked at the Google Earth, luckily for Google Earth, the right next day of the occurrence of the tornado, the Tuscaloosa tornado had the Google Earth photograph. So that's very current. So we can able to use that information. For Joplin, I know the terrain because I went there and looked at it. But only thing is their photograph from Google Earth is maybe 1 week later or something like that. But on the other end, there are other tornadoes also. We looked at it. We were trying to look what are the tornadoes can suit. The criteria are you need to have terrain, and then you need to have a Google Earth picture which is reasonably well taken, very close to the date of the damages.
So what did he and other researchers find in this data?
We took the tornado path, and wherever there was a hill, we tried to look what is happening when the tornado was going up the hill, then when the tornado goes down the hill, what level of damage is there. That's where we were reporting. What we found many of the places is when it is going up the hill, there were more damages. When it is going on the same hill, down the hill, less damage.
But Dr. Selvam says that this tenet of the research has led to some misconceptions. Upon reading the raw report, he says that some have interpreted it to mean that valleys between hills are always more protected. But he says that there are several variables that led to the conclusion that tornadoes cause more damage going up one side of a hill than that same tornado going down the opposite side of the very same hill.
It is more the size of the hill, the distance between the hill, the valley, if it is there, how much is there, all of those things are matters. But in that study, what we did is we took different places, the damage pictures, and then tried to show there is more damage, less damage. And then also there is in Tuscaloosa tornado, we found a situation wherein on the path of the tornado, there is a hill all around, then there's a valley in between, but it's not a wide valley, it's a small valley around.
He says that there was more damage to structures at the top of the hills than to structures in the relatively narrow space between the hills, leading to the conclusion that areas are surrounded by hills show less damage than areas on the exterior of the same hills. Another finding outlined in the research paper, which Dr. Selvam and his graduate assistant Nafal Ahmed presented earlier this year, is that if possible, tornadoes tend to climb the ridge of a hill rather than go down the leeward side. The reason given for such movement is that tornadoes will logically be more attracted to areas of higher elevation that have lower atmospheric pressure, thus causing the tornado to rotate at a higher velocity. And though Dr. Selvam says that these findings are based on preliminary models, he says that if he is able to further quantify the research, that he hopes it could have implications in urban planning.
Again, it always comes to the cost. So I'm hoping that we come up with some ideas, reasonably good ideas, which is reasonable, less cost, but we can protect a certain region. Maybe the cities and other people may be able to contact us. Maybe we can help them to design what we call man-made structures, which can protect reasonably those areas.
But for a building to reasonably withstand a tornado, which is a subject Dr. Selvam has studied for many years, he says it must be an engineered structure. As an example, he points to St. John's Hospital in Joplin.
I consider that to be well-engineered structure. So if you look, it is also on the right, on the same path of the tornado. Right by the site surrounding, you would see a lot of failures, office buildings to residential buildings to whatever. On the other hand, St. John's building is right there, structurally intact. Only failures are window glass, whatever architectural and other failures. But as a structure, even today, it is there, and many people were there, and they were fine.
He says that structures built with conventional construction techniques, using 2x4 timbers and nails, are not necessarily engineered to withstand the forces of major tornadoes, regardless of where they are built on the hill in relation to the trajectory of the tornado. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
It is Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello.
And howdy.
I think.
Yes.
I'm going to start trying out accents on the air because we're starting rehearsals for the Gridiron Show.
Gridiron is where many journalists get together and poke fun of newsmakers, and it's usually in October.
So we'll have a little Paula Deen, and we'll have some Granny Clampett. So if you start hearing weird accents, I have not lost my mind. I'm just rehearsing on you.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about visual arts.
Let's do.
Tomorrow is First Thursday.
Yes, it is, at Fayetteville Underground and all over the Fayetteville Square.
Photographer Terry Duchon and fiber textile artist Jeannie Vockroth will be on display at, well, actually their work will be
yes.
at the Fayetteville Underground.
Yes.
It's first Friday this week.
In Bentonville, downtown Bentonville.
And the beginning of the Slaughter Pen Jam Music Festival.
Bicycles and music.
Exactly. Which sounds really dangerous, but that's just my biking. Arkansas Champion Trees and Artist Journey is on show starting this weekend at the Smith Pendergraft Campus Center at UAFS. We've written about her when her exhibit was up here.
Right.
Artist Linda Williams Palmer. And there's a reception from 3 to 5 on September 8th.
Right.
And Sensory Iconoclasts opens on September 9th at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale with a reception from 6 to 8 p.m. September 12th. This is the pairing of food and art.
Right.
And at the same time, there will be a video installation in the other gallery at ACO exploring the apocalyptic architecture of Coyne Harvey.
Coyne Harvey, who was convinced the world was going to end before now.
And built a resort at Montanay and then built this huge amphitheater and then finally built his tomb.
Actually, and I was a bit unfair. I don't think he thought the world was going to end, but he thought civilization was in for a rough, rough ride.
And he might have been right. We've had some rough
That's
rides.
True. That's true.
But this will be an interesting, they describe it as a video meditation.
Right.
And that will be happening at the same time through October 4th at ACO.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Plenty of music news. I believe the Harvest Festival music schedule has been released as of today.
It has. I haven't had time to look at it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
And there will be a CD release party tomorrow evening beginning at 6:30 during the party on the patio at Powerhouse Seafood and Grill in Fayetteville. This is a CD release party that celebrates Sounds Made in the Mountains, Volume 2. It's an album featuring original songs by 15 local bands. Cass Harris, The Downtown Livewires, Adams Collins, Richard Burnett, Brickfield's Duo, Leah and the Mojo Doctors, and Earl and Them, all of whom are featured on the new CD, will also be on the stage at the patio for an evening of live and local music. The party then concludes with Isaiah's All-Stars and a jam featuring several artists from the lineup. The event is hosted by First Security Bank. Admission, $5 at the door. The CD will also be available for purchase at the party and at any First Security Bank in Northwest Arkansas. All proceeds from the sale of the CD directly benefit local homeless students. In early 2013, the Communities and Family Institute at the U of A administered a point-in-time census of the homeless in Northwest Arkansas. According to the University of Arkansas report, an estimated 2,249 individuals were homeless, an 18% increase since 2011. The findings revealed that about half of the area's homeless population enrolled in kindergarten through 12th grade.
So earlier this summer, we did a story on the 33rd Annual Ozarks Genealogical Society Conference. It was scheduled for September 13th and 14th in Springfield, Missouri, but I found out over the weekend that it's been canceled. The publicity chairwoman, Mitzi Zare, says the hotel property where the conference was scheduled to be went out of business and closed last week. And she said it was so unexpected that they didn't really have time to find a new location. And so that's unfortunate. But if you want to find out more about the Ozarks Genealogical Society, you can visit ozarksgs.org. A conference that is happening, NOARC, Northwest Arkansas Human Resource Association. This group is presenting Managers Conference, the Building Blocks of Leadership and Management, Thursday, September 12th at the Springdale Holiday Inn. This conference is designed for all levels of management, from manufacturing to small business. Registration information available online at noark.org.
KUAF is supported by the Walmart Visitor Center Museum. This newly remodeled and expanded center is family friendly and features two interactive galleries, plus the Walton's Five and Dime 1950s style soda fountain, located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m. 277-8493 or Facebook/Walmart Visitor Center Museum for more information.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
Last week, the Dale Bumpers College of Agriculture, Food, and Life Sciences at the University of Arkansas was, for the very first time, placed on the list of the top 100 agricultural and forestry colleges in the world. Dr. Mike Veda, the dean of the Bumpers College, says he wasn't aware of the exact date the QS World Rankings would be released. So he says it was a surprise email that contained pleasant news.
Very pleasant news at that. We were not aware that the QS World Rankings were going to be coming out. We did aspire to have rankings, and we are very proud of them to be number 22 in the U.S. and tied for 51st in the world.
The 2013-2014 QS Rankings placed the Dale Bumpers College at number 51 in the world and number 22 in the United States. About one-third of the colleges on the list are American institutions. There are more than 25 countries represented. The overall leader, according to the QS rankings, is the University of California, Davis. A Dutch university is ranked second, Cornell third. Dr. Veda says the high ranking for the Bumpers College on an international list is important.
Well, the QS rankings are designed for international students in making selections of quality universities. The survey had included some 2,800 different universities from around the world, and so we are pleased as punch to be ranked so highly.
The overall rankings are tabulated using a collection of individual scores for categories, including academic and employer reputation surveys, faculty to student ratio, and the proportion of international students and faculty. Dean Veda says the new rankings reflect the Bumpers College efforts to address food and related subjects on a global scale. A copy of Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, sits prominently on a shelf just outside the dean's office. He says it's imperative to have a worldview.
Well, in the Bumpers College, our majors span the whole spectrum of the food system and food businesses, how they affect food production, food quality, food product development, human nutrition, even human quality of life through hospitality, healthy body image, and healthy lifelong behavioral eating patterns. So we proudly present ourselves as the college in the businesses of foods, family, and the environment. This is a global marketplace. The businesses of foods, our students need to know who their prospective partners are, who their prospective competitors are in the world, and particularly where the markets are for them to succeed.
The QS Top 100 ranking comes after a six-year growth spurt at the Bumpers College. Dean Veda says 2007 enrollment in the college was about 1,700 students. Last year, there were more than 2,100 students in the college. He says the growth from the academic year that began in fall 2011 and the one that began last fall was 11%. He credits part of that enrollment increase to what he calls value-added experiences for undergraduate and graduate students alike in the college.
We've had several experiences in the last few years of engaging our students beyond the classroom. Honors drill sections, project-based learning, interdisciplinary team-based courses where students were asked to address specific problems. Some of those problems were commissioned by external private sector sponsors, and they would spend their academic time working on those for a capstone experience and present their findings back to those corporate private sector sponsors. That's a real-world learning experience.
He says the recently launched Bumpers Distinguished Lecture Series is another example of additional opportunities for students. The first two speakers in the series have been former President Bill Clinton and current U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack.
Coming up just in September, we will have the Chief Administrator of the U.S. Agency of International Development, Raj Shah. He will be here on September 9th. In a partnership experience between the Bumpers College and the Walton College, and he will be having engagement with students both in the classroom and over luncheon discussions, and he will provide a direct challenge to our students to engage in international development opportunities. And his premier message is public-private sector partnerships. We are proud that we're already engaged in that line of reasoning, and our efforts are aligned with helping the U.S. effort as well as the international effort for success.
The University of Arkansas has established a very public goal of becoming a top 50 public university in the future, and Dean Veda says these recent QS rankings for the Bumpers College should help the university achieve that goal. Arkansas is one of seven schools from the Southeastern Conference to be included in the top 100 in the world, along with Texas A&M, Georgia, Florida, Auburn, Louisiana State, and Missouri. Dean Veda says the cooperation between the Bumpers College and the private sector will continue to be an emphasis in the near future.
Well, engagement with the private sector is key because one of the three tenets of all land-grant universities, going back to the Morrill Act, is engagement into the communities that we exist. In today's world, that translates to economic development opportunities and also for career placement for our students. So we are proud to be contributing to the Arkansas economy and the U.S. economy by keeping our businesses associated with foods and the environment very strong.
Mike Veda is the dean of the Dale Bumpers College of Agriculture, Food, and Life Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Last week, the college was listed among the top 100 colleges in the world in agriculture and forestry by the QS World Rankings.
This is Ozarks at Large. For some soldiers coming back from service overseas, the transition back to life in the United States can be difficult. For the past several years, many veterans have been helped, even if just a little bit, by groups of quilters. The National Quilts of Valor Project provides handmade quilts to men and women returning from military service. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes recently met with some quilters who have been devoting time to the project.
The National Quilts of Valor organization began in 2003 with Blue Star mother Catherine Roberts of Delaware. She wanted to ensure returning soldiers, like her own son, who'd served in the Iraq War, felt appreciated and welcomed back after their service. Seeking a way to build bridges, she began to connect quilt toppers, the women who piece the quilts, with long armors, the women who machine quilt the fabrics. Together, they worked toward their goal of covering all returning servicemen and women with a symbol of appreciation. There's also a spiritual component to their work. They often pray over the quilts as they're being made. And in a little town like Morrilton, Arkansas, where the Conway County Peacemakers Group meets, they typically know the people they're making quilts for. Veterans in their own communities, often their husbands, sons, daughters, or cousins. I met up with the local chapter, including Susie Kendrick, Judy King, Carolyn Chapman, and Catherine Pruitt, at Catherine's fabric store in Morrilton to learn more about how they came to start this local group.
I brought it down here and presented it to her and her husband, George, and they just jumped right on it. He's a Vietnam vet, and it just got started like that.
I don't know how I found out about it. I just showed up over here one day. Anywhere there's fabric, I show up.
It was raining. Mary says, get your sewing machine out. You're going to learn how to sew. I'm like, no. I was terrified of my sewing machine. I said, no, I really don't want to.
It's your best
friend. Get your sewing machine out, and we're going to learn how to sew. So we started about 8:30 on a Saturday morning, and by 9 o'clock, I had my first quilt. Mary taught me, and I've made 6, 7, 8. I'm on my 9th one.
When the bug bites, you've got it bad.
And her 95-year-old sister has just made her 4th one. Mary has just done her 4th one. Her daughter has done 2. And her 7-year-old grandson is working on his first one. He's piecing.
Usually what I do is I travel the state and try and get Quilts of Valor started. Mm-hmm. Two, three weekends ago, I went to Greenland and up in the Fayetteville area and had a lot of interest up there. And there's already started Quilts of Valor in Faulkner County. And I'm going to Hot Springs in 2 weeks and get something interested, you know, for the women to get interested in that also. And then I go out there and try and collect money for that. That's pays for our materials. And we use 100% cotton, quality cotton, thread and material that we get here from Catherine's. And then we have two women at Long Arm that put the quilt tops together to make a quilt. And some of these women have husbands that were in World War II and one and all the other wars.
I have a son that was in Iraq. So.
And last year at the high school on Veterans Day, we gave out, 10 quilts?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
It was 10 quilts. And we had a jar out there that when the veterans came in, they filled out, you know, their name, what war they were in. And these are all done with, out of our hearts, love and a lot of prayers. And look what they did for us.
And there was a little World War II guy that I presented a quilt to that it goes to my church. And he saw me at church Sunday and he says, I want you to know everyone in my apartment complex has seen my quilt. I'm like, good. Does that mean you like it? Oh, yes. I love it. But he said, everyone in my apartment complex has seen my quilt. I'm like, good. Yeah. He was proud.
I think they're just thrilled to death. Yeah. Every one of them just can't express themselves. And they'll come in here and they'll say, you just don't know what it meant to me to receive this. And I said, yes, I do, because I know what it meant to us to give it to them. Because there's just a special feeling.
This past 4th of July, the Conway County Peacemakers Group gave out 70 quilts to area veterans during a special celebration, which included Congressman Tim Griffin, a local clogging group, and several speakers. This Veterans Day, they'll be giving out many more. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
You can learn more about the National Quilt of Valor Foundation at qovf.org. And you can follow Meredith Martin-Motes at her blog, BoiledDownJuice.com.
On a farm near Decatur in western Benton County, a team of farmers walk toward a collection of chicken houses as the sun rises. Chicken houses in rural Benton County, not that unusual. A poultry business operated by the grandson of the founder of Peterson Farms, not unexpected. But this farm doesn't look like most of the commercial poultry interests across the country. Robert Smith, the farm manager for Crystal Lake Farms, turns a gear that opens a series of doors on a chicken house to let young chicks waddle outside on their own. These chicks are allowed to go outside when the weather allows, giving the chicks a chance to roam around the field as part of the philosophy at Crystal Lake Farms, according to Smith.
I've had the guys that work out here laugh at me. I've come up with some crazy ideas, some that have worked, some that haven't, but there'll be people show up at this chicken house and I'm doing nothing but sitting there on a bucket. What's that chicken telling me he wants? You know, you have to spend time and give the bird what he wants, and you have to sit around and figure out what he's trying to tell you.
Robert Smith is a lifelong farmer. He was a fourth-generation farmer for Peterson Farms. So when he talks about observing chicks and letting them tell him what they want, you listen. He's seen and worked the modern chicken house, and he thinks there are better ways to raise the birds, and not all of the methods are exactly new.
And what's the term I try to use, going back to the future?
Yeah, something like that.
We're trying to stay as humane and animal-friendly as at all possible, but use modern genetics to in old-fashioned bird raising situations.
We've raised the other commercial breeds out here in conjunction with ours, and it's very noticeable that those birds don't want to go outside.
Blake Evans is the grandson of the founder of Peterson Farms, Lloyd Peterson, who started his poultry business more than 60 years ago. Blake and his team are raising Crystal Lake Free Rangers, a breed he says thrives on foraging in open pasture. He says this bird is being raised for a consumer not looking for a typical chicken.
One of the things that we think is a huge plus for our breed is it loves to get outside and forage. And, you know, you talk to most people, just the other commercial breeds, they'll stay inside, and ours just love to get out and go.
When the chicks are inside in the houses on the farm, they still have room to move. Again, Robert Smith, the farm manager.
The typical bird has about 0.75 square foot per bird when they get old. These have 1.42 average or something like that, almost twice as much room as a mainstream type broiler.
Robert says there are about 4,700 birds in each half of this house. The chicks will stay in the same house from their first day until they're taken from the farm. So there is a constant rotation on Crystal Lake Farms. Houses with the youngest birds eventually become the houses with the oldest. Robert says letting the chicks have hours outside means the animals can do what they do naturally. Richard Udale, the geneticist on the Crystal Lake Farms team, says that exercise, not just going to the feeder and then sitting down, has benefits on the farm and at the market.
Is that you don't see these birds having any problems with mobility. How old are these rubbers? 6 weeks?
6 months.
6 months. So they're really starting to put on the weight now and the meat. But they're able to get around because they've got a good set of legs under them that's developed and mature enough to carry that weight. And I think that's one of the breakthroughs that we've made really in trying to do this.
Blake Evans says the experiments and the setup here have taken time. The work on this farm began in 2009, and they're almost ready to have the Crystal Lake brand available on retail shelves. That will begin in just a few months. Blake says the entire process has been undertaken in accordance with standards established by the Global Animal Partnership.
If you've been in a conventional house, I mean, there's solid walls, so there's no sunlight coming in. All the air is coming in through cool cell pads, and you know how much mold and bacteria and virus, and it all goes through there. So, I mean, the birds are definitely regulated with, you know, a constant temperature and airflow, but, you know, fresh air and sunlight, those are a couple of the things that really allow the chicken to be natural and help contribute to the good taste.
Farm manager Robert Smith says the rules set by the Global Animal Partnership cover the birds from before they're hatched until they're taken to market.
Most commercial birds, the guys, when they go out to catch 10 to 12 birds at a time just by one leg, these birds for this Global Animal Partnership, five at a time is the most we can carry. They have to be carried by two legs, so they don't do as much flopping and fighting. It's all an animal welfare issue. I mean, we're trying to cover every animal welfare issue we can cover.
The birds here are slower growing and live a little longer than many other commercially raised chickens. They're on the farm about 2 weeks longer, according to Blake. Working with this breed and with these operations takes a small leap of faith, the experience these farmers have each accumulated, some intuition, and paperwork. Inside each chicken house are clipboards with detailed spreadsheets.
So we'll write down any culls or mortality, the days that we're opening the doors because the weather is fine. If there's a hazard like snow or ice or tornado, we mark that down. You know, how many birds we put in every house and how many pounds per square feet that is, and just to track our averages. And so we follow a lot of data, and that just helps us get better.
This setup fewer birds per square foot and a longer time to market raises the cost to raise each bird, and that price difference will be reflected somewhat on retail shelves. But the Crystal Lake team believes there are shoppers who want chickens raised this way. The original plan was to be available on shelves by the end of 2013. Blake says they've pushed that timeline back slightly.
Let's see, we started developing the breed almost from scratch, I would say, in 2009 in March. And our intention was to come into retail sales this year. We're really pushing that to the start of 2014. And we knew immediately when we started developing this breed, you don't want to sell it to the public when it's not ready. And so we've just been holding back and using it ourselves and, you know, watching how it performs so we can give people a real accurate description of what this will do.
And for Robert Smith, the farm manager at Crystal Lake Farms, this operation has brought him full circle.
For me, it's been kind of a gradual deal. Even when Mr. Peterson was alive, Richard 2003 and 4, out here on this particular time farm, we did an all-natural product. We didn't place them near as thick, and we used an all-natural feed. We didn't do the outside conditions or GAP certified. But even then, you know, noticing the different taste and texture of the product, and this is even a lot greater than that was. But it's been, for me, it's been kind of gradual. And plus, I was born and raised in the chicken business. My dad built his first chicken house when I was 6 years old, and we didn't used to have foggers and fans and everything to keep birds cool. I can remember when the birds would get 4 or 5 weeks old in the summertime, you opened up side doors and indoors and let them head to the shade tree to keep them cool in the summer. And a lot of this is, you know, like I said earlier, going back to the future. So it was gradual for me, but it was pretty easy for me to buy into.
This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, James Franco is bringing William Faulkner's famously complicated novel, As I Lay Dying, to the big screen. How have screenwriters past and present tackled ambitious adaptations?
A novel is not structured like a movie, so you have to give yourself liberty to really make changes for stuff that fits the cinema.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF. Support for KUAF comes from Dog Party USA, hosting its annual Dogs Night Out Saturday, September 7th at 6 p.m. This fundraiser is a progressive gourmet meal for the dogs and an evening of food and live music for their owners. Tickets are available at the door with proceeds to benefit the Humane Society of the Ozarks. More information is available on Facebook or at dogpartyusa.com. The Yonder Mountains Harvest Music Festival is hosting its annual songwriting contest and Fiddlin' and Pickin' contest in October. Submissions are due by September 16th and spots are limited. More information is available online at yonderharvestfestival.com/activities.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Van Buren.
Excellent. You have a good evening last night?
Didn't do much. My mom is in town.
Oh, yay.
Staying with me for a week, so we watch Gosford Park.
I don't know what that is.
It's a Robert Altman movie, kind of a murder mystery, written by Julian Fellows, who also wrote, is the chief writer for, that show on PBS.
Downton Abbey?
Downton Abbey, that's the one.
Okay.
Yes.
Sounds like fun.
It was
a lot calmer than my night.
And you went to all sorts of things last night.
Oh, man, I went to Savor the Flavor, but we also wanted to go to Jersey Boys, so we had mapped out how to do like all the restaurants in about an hour and a half.
Did you get it? Did you accomplish your task?
We did not make it to 2 before the show, but somebody mentioned that you could run out at intermission. So at intermission, we ran out to one we had. Yes. At intermission, we ran out to one that we had not gotten to. So there was only one that we didn't make it to.
So, the Energizer Bunny would be proud.
Right? Savor the Flavor was fabulous. Jersey Boys was fabulous. Opened last night. The cast was, of course, crazy talented, and it was a lot of fun. So you still have about, I guess, another 6 nights of shows or so to go check that out at the Walton Arts Center. So good times.
All right. Well, very good. Christina and I will be here tomorrow for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large, will we not?
You will, as far as I know.
Yeah, well, that's the plan.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic Wednesday.